Well, Matt Drudge has just emailed me a story. Of course, you know, drudgereport.com, about that incredible earthquake at northern Japan that damaged its nuclear plant. Well, now the radioactive water leak at that area was apparently 50% bigger than previously announced, but they say still below danger levels. Let's hope. The water leaked into the Sea of Japan after Monday's 6.8 magnitude earthquake that shook the 7 reactor plant there. Man, that's scary stuff. It really is. One day something big's going to happen to this planet. Thank you, Matt. Matt Drudge, drudgereport.com. Fallen angels, the paranormal, global warming, quantum physics, all of that put together tonight with Gateway of the Gods. Craig Hines is next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, in a few moments, Lex will have posted on the coasttocoastam.com website, and look for the Digicam icon, a picture of Stanton Friedman, Jesse Marcel Jr., Larry King, and me. We have a little photograph of us when we were on the Larry King show on Friday. Neat photo. But I want to forewarn you, it looks like Larry's been photoshopped into the picture. He was really there. He really was. But take a look at it. It'll be up there on the Digicam soon. As soon as Lex posts it, I'll let you know. Craig Hines, he's an artist with nearly 2 decades of experience. His interest in computers began at an early age and has only been rivaled by his fascination with ancient civilizations, paranormal phenomena, science, and technology. Like all of you, his focused research on what would later become Gateway of the Gods began in 1999, continues through today. He believes that his training in multimedia, coupled with his knowledge of the paranormal, has given him a very unique point of view, perspective. GatewayOfTheGods.com is his website. Of course, linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. It's going to be a fascinating night with Craig Hines. Hey, Craig, welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me on.
Nice work here.
Thank you.
How did you... You know, you're accomplished in computers, accomplished in art. You're very meticulous at what you do. How did you kind of evolve into this area?
Well, as it said in the bio, I've always been interested in these kind of topics. So, you know, whenever I was growing up, I would always watch shows like Sightings that was on, I believe, Fox, and other shows like X-Files or just paranormal-themed shows. So it was just sort of natural for me to gravitate towards that and incorporate it into my work.
They're coming out with a new X-Files movie pretty soon, by the way.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, that's going to be exciting. The Gateway of the Gods is a title you picked for this book, and there's a reason you did. As a matter of fact, I looked at the trailer on your website, which is fascinating. And is going to require you to explain this, because it's kind of spooky, correct?
Yeah, it is. I wanted to have a sense of mystery to it. It's kind of involved, but really the title is just simply the meaning of Babel, which is Gateway of God. And throughout all my research, I kept finding this recurring theme of the Gateway of God. It's hidden in all sorts of places, but once you know to look for it, I can't look back now because I just see it everywhere.
When you talk about the gateway, are you talking about a portal? What is it?
I believe it is some kind of portal, but probably more accurately, based on what the text described, it's some sort of translation device. Essentially, what it does is it takes matter from one dimension, is say a dimension that we're not aware of, and it translates it into a form that is compatible with our dimension.
Okay, you're going to have a lot of people listening tonight, many of whom will say, man, this guy's right on. And some will say, what is he saying? These are your theories based on your perspective, your work, and of course, I think some of the work you've done watching and reading others who have looked at a lot of these before. I got to believe that in some cases, it's kind of controversial for you, isn't it?
Oh, it will be, because there's a lot of information that people have learned while growing up that they thought they knew, and it's not that it's necessarily wrong, but it's just that they haven't had the context clues to really put it into perspective. And so what I really hope is that I can encourage people to look at things in a different way so that they'll gain this new perspective.
And you generally all get to the same answers, but you get there on a different trip.
Yeah, as you explained earlier, I'm very meticulous, so I really tried to check all my sources and double-check them and verify things in at least two or three other places before I would put it in the book as evidence for what I'm claiming.
In the work that you've done, what did you find to be as probably the most fascinating for you?
Well, I would have to say in some ways, just the recurring symbolic themes that open up new doorways to understanding the stories that are in the Bible and other ancient texts, where on one hand you're given a nice story that, you know, is just good information, but if you know these little clues or things to look for, there's a second story located underneath that.
Let's talk a little bit, of course, about the modern concept of the angelic world, which it does fascinate me. It truly does. And I've got my perspective to truly believe that they were formed way before mankind was, and there was a reason for that. But let's get your take, first of all, on that, because that's going to point us in the direction tonight, Craig, I think, of the things we'll be talking about.
Yeah, sure. Basically, my difference of opinion with a lot of people in the modern day is that they view as angels or something that are constantly surrounding us. And while that might be the case, I've also read so many stories where they've just encountered people that they're at an electronics store and somebody offers them advice or something like that, and then they claim that the person seemed to just vanish, you know, before they could thank them. To me, those don't seem like actual angelic encounters, but for many of the stories that read in modern books, that's what is told. And whenever you go back and compare it to the ancient text, it's very different. Usually the angelic beings were frightening because they were just so powerful and awe-inspiring.
Well, here's an example. A person called my show years ago and was talking about, and it was an angelic hotline night, and he said that he was drowning in the ocean. He went swimming for a little bit, and he kind of got pushed out a little further and a little further, and he said, George, I was exhausted. I was going down for the count. And as he was underwater, and it was a blue sky, so he could still see up, a hand went right through the water, and he obviously lunged for it, grabbed it, and it pulled him up, you know, and he's gasping for air. He's looking around. He's a couple hundred feet offshore. There's nobody there. I mean, either the person swam out there, pulled him out, and drowned, or something very unusual happened, and he doesn't think anybody swam out there because, you know, there were people on the beach side. He thinks that was an angelic intervention.
It could be, but really we don't know. Now, I'm not saying that his experience wasn't real. It very well could have been. It's just we don't know if it really was an angel. You know, it could have been another type of spirit being, or it could have been numerous other possibilities, but most people, even with situations like that, they automatically attribute it to being an angel. And I'm just arguing that perhaps it wasn't.
Nicolas Cage and City of Angels, you see that movie?
Many years ago.
All right, what'd you think of it? Hollywood?
What was that?
Hollywood?
Kind of, yeah.
So you don't think they really exist that way?
Not from based on what I've read.
Well, now let's talk about the fallen angels and your perspective of that.
Sure. Well, basically, most people think they also know the story of the fallen angels if you ask the general population on the street. Now, I know the Coast audience is more familiar with the story of the fallen angels, and it involves the Book of Enoch, and the angels were known as the Watchers and the Sons of God, who came down and cohabitated with humans and married women and had children with them. So that's the angle that I took it, because that is actually more biblically authentic than the story that most people understand of Lucifer rebelling against God and leading the angels, you know, in this war in heaven and everything like that.
Is there science behind it?
In what way do you mean science?
I mean, is it more scientific as opposed to metaphysical?
Well, I would say that the evidence that I've encountered, it does seem that, I don't want to say it's scientific, but the evidence that is available, even including some bones or other things like that, do lend credibility to the Book of Enoch story as opposed to, like, as I said, the Luciferian Rebellion.
Okay,
story.
All right. For everybody's benefit, why don't you kind of give us a brief summary of both?
Sure. Well, as I said, most people would think that there's this being that is opposite God who's called Lucifer or Satan, and that wanted to basically usurp the throne of God. And whenever you go and read the Bible, that actually isn't in there. What it is it's a combination of a few different passages and an astronomical teaching referring to the planet Venus, where they were comparing, like, the king of Tyre. They refer to him as Lucifer, which the dawn star. And they're saying that how he tried to rise to heaven and take over the throne of God, but didn't succeed and was thrown down to Sheol, which is the underworld. Well, in astronomical terms, that's talking about Venus that rises in the morning and is known as the dawn star.
Right.
And it rises above the sun, so before the sun, but eventually the sun overtakes it. So it was just comparing it to this mythology about a being that tried to overtake God but couldn't.
All right, and Enoch?
In Enoch, that seems more plausible in my mind because it's all around the world they refer to this contact experience with these beings that were known as the Shining Ones or the Kachinas or Elves or the Elohim. And essentially they all say the same thing, that they came here to teach and instruct mankind and to help build civilizations, and things got a little carried away, and so some of them had to be banished.
So we'll get into the who and why, but you believe we were visited then?
I think there's strong evidence to indicate that.
And interpreted then as, by some, angels, by others as truly visitors from another spot?
Yes.
What about dimensional? Does that come up at all in any of your work? That we're not talking about planetary beings here, but
yeah,
dimensional.
I think it's much more likely that these beings exist in another dimension that's parallel to our own.
Okay, so in your theories would echo Jacques Vallée and several others now who have decided that we aren't in the mists of extraterrestrial visitations, but that they are truly dimensional. But what about these crafts, Craig, that we see? I mean, to me, they're physical.
That very well might be, and it's possible. I mean, they could appear physical and take on physical properties. It's just with my research, I'm trying not to group everything in together where I do think that it's quite possible that we're being visited by extraterrestrials, even if they're interdimensional as well. But I just don't know if I'm ready to jump to the conclusion that, you know, ETs and UFOs are definitively linked to the angelic beings.
Okay, so let's push them aside for a moment. If we have then these dimensional beings have been coming to this planet, why, in your opinion? Why did they come here?
Well, as I said, in the Book of Enoch, in the Book of Jubilees, the original story was that they were supposed to basically give humanity a jump start. They were supposed to teach us about civilization and just give us different laws and how to obey them, and essentially just give us a head start so that we could become civilized.
You think it's their role to do that?
For most of them, because a lot of times they act as ambassadors of God, which is essentially what the term angel means. It means messenger or ambassador of God.
Were we already here when they visited us?
I believe so, yes.
So you're not saying we were seeded by them or genetically altered by them?
I don't think so.
The visitations were done when, in your opinion?
It's hard to pinpoint exactly. I would say many of them happened at least 6,000 years ago, if not longer. And some of them could have even been happening maybe just 1,000 years ago. It's just on a smaller scale at that point.
Now, are you a believer that mankind is way older than 6,000 years?
Sure.
There are some who believe this planet is only 6,000 years old.
Yeah, sure. I definitely believe that.
You don't believe that?
Well, I believe that there's in the evolutionary theory and with the old Earth.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's good to know that perspective. Okay. So when this visitation occurred through this other dimension, how did they become physical?
Well, that gets into the gateways. And something that I kept noticing throughout the text was that it referred to these gates of heaven that would, it would refer to them translating the angels here. And it worked both ways. For instance, in the Book of Enoch, it describes how Enoch was translated to heaven. And something I found very interesting was in the Book of Enoch, if you read a few different translations of it, it actually says that all of his flesh was dissolved and he was transformed. And according to later Jewish text, he was known as to become the angel Metatron.
Now, do you, when you say transformed, I mean, is it like Star Trek where they were beamed aboard?
In some ways, I would say that, but it's basically that it's translating it. If you compare it to language, it's like translating English into French. Or it still has the same meaning and the same purposes, but essentially it's just changing the format of their bodies so that they can operate in these other dimensions. So they might only be moving a millimeter away from where they're standing at that moment, but it's in another dimension which overlaps our own, but we can't directly interact with without that translation.
So it's a good time now then for you to explain the graphic, the cover of Gateway of the Gods, because I think that depicts exactly what you're talking about right now.
Sure. Basically, I sort of got the inspiration from the reference to Jacob's ladder, where it said that, you know, Jacob was dreaming and he saw a ladder that was set up on the earth. But if you read the text, it actually says that it was more likely a stairway or a ramp, probably referring to what is known as a Mesopotamian ziggurat, which are the stepped pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
And so it said that he saw God standing at the top and the angels ascending and descending. And he said that, you know, that this is the gate of heaven. And so that provided the inspiration for the cover, where I depict the ancient ziggurat with the angels ascending and descending down the stairway.
You have put glowing wings on these creatures. How come?
Basically, it was more of an artistic rendition to, since so many people associate wings with the beings. And even in the ancient artwork, they show that. However, in many times, sometimes the text described them with wings, other times it doesn't. I just sort of wanted to go for an artistic representation to show that they weren't necessarily human and they had this glowing, shining appearance about them.
Craig, where did the, I guess, the descriptions of the devil then come from? You know, Lucifer, those fallen angels, the bad ones, the evil ones, because I don't hear you talking about that.
Well, it actually evolved over a long period of time. A lot of it goes back to one of the first fallen angels in the Book of Enoch story, who was known as Azazel. And he's referred to briefly in the Bible, and a lot of times the name is translated as scapegoat. And so basically they would do the sacrifice where they would put all the sins of the Jewish people on the goat and then send it out into the desert as a sacrifice to Azazel. And basically, so that the goat figure was associated with him, and then over time, you've seen depictions of the Satan figure with the horns,
yes,
and everything, and even with the inverted pentagram, they oftentimes draw a goat's head in with that.
See, I think he might have been a reptilian creature. You never know.
Yeah, that could be, and that would actually probably be more biblically accurate. I'm just saying that it's not that he was actually a goat, it's just that the name means scapegoat, because in the Book of Enoch, he was the one who was blamed for everything. Shemyaza was the leader of the fallen angels, but he repented for his misdeeds, and so he wasn't found guilty of them. And Azazel, since he taught so many horrific things, he was blamed for everything. And so that's why his name was translated as scapegoat.
Okay, and this is going to open up the door for a lot of other things we're going to talk about in just a moment with you. Craig Hines, our special guest. Digicam is up at coasttocoastam.com. Just hit your refresh button, then look for the Digicam icon there. The picture of the group of us with Larry King. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Craig Hines, Gateway of the Gods. We'll be back with Craig in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Craig, if you would, kind of paint us a picture of what happened when these angels came through this portal and what was going on? What do you, the reaction, for example, of human beings at the time?
Well, you have quite a few different stories, but a lot of times, basically, as I was explaining earlier, the angels themselves were awe-inspiring, and it's because they also had this shining appearance about them. And there were many times where they were described like they would have to be cloaked to sort of disguise themselves so as to not attract attention, like as in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, because once everybody saw them, it attracted the townspeople to the place where they were. There's also the story of Jacob, who whenever he was wrestling with an angel, and it says that they wrestled all night long, and then whenever the sun was rising, the angel begged him to let him go before the sun rose, and he wouldn't let him go until...
Sounds like a vampire, Craig.
Well, in some ways, and I think perhaps that the angels might have provided sort of a template for some of the vampire stories. Because whenever you read the text, it actually describes how the reason that they stood out from the people is because they had white skin and white hair that was very different from everybody else. And I believe that with the angel that was wrestling with Jacob, it was because since he had such white skin, similar to like an albino person,
right,
that he was afraid of the sunlight would burn him.
That's interesting. Okay, and at what point do the Nephilim come in?
Well, I go with the view that the Nephilim were the hybrid offspring between the angels and humans. Some people try to equate the Nephilim as being the angels, and to me, the jury's still out. I tend to think that the title does refer more to the hybrid offspring, especially as Michael Heiser has been on the show just recently, and he's even pointed out in past shows about how there's a very specific spelling of Nephilim in the Book of Numbers, which indicates an Aramaic root. And in the Aramaic root, that suggests that it should be rendered as giant. And that's usually referring to the children.
I have heard that they have some of these bones of giants. And then I've heard that, no, they're not real. They're hoaxes. What do you hear?
Well, whenever I investigated a lot of that, most of them I found out to be hoaxes, fabrications, or just misunderstandings of things that, you know, they thought it was belonging to a giant, but it really wasn't. I have come across a few, you know, fossils that are interesting in my opinion. For instance, I remember reading in the magazine Atlantis Rising that there was this strange elongated skull. It didn't have any of the cranial knitting. Like, you know, whenever most people are born, their skulls are in these fragmented pieces, and so the skull, you know, forms together. And what made this skull interesting was because it didn't have the median knitting. And according to a lot of medical professionals, they said that that was impossible. And I started thinking about that. And I was like, well, wait, that actually might be a clue that is a hybrid offspring, because if we go back to what I was referring to, this gateway device, when the angels would come to the earth, essentially it describes them as having bodies built for them, which also would suggest that might be why they had the white skin and white hair, because they had never been exposed to the sun. They didn't inherit any genetics from parents like we do. And so if they were formed that way, then they wouldn't need to have the cranial knitting in their own skulls, because they weren't born like humans were. And so if they mated with a human, there's a chance that the child might actually have some of those traits, such as the lack of the median knitting.
Now, you've also heard, though, that the Nephilim had physical deformities, right? They had their six fingers, they had six toes.
Sure, and I also think that that's another indication, because in the text it says that the angels mated with humans, and normally crossbreeding between different species is impossible. Even whenever you look at most sci-fi stories, they have it, even though that's not accurate. But it's possible if their bodies of the angels were made that they might be just compatible enough with humans that they could mate with us, but just different enough that their children would have a lot of deformities.
I'm having a hard time trying to believe that something dimensional would become physical and then be able to mate, let's say. But I guess if you're saying that they teleported here, basically, where they dematerialized, rematerialized as something physical, is that what happened?
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of hard to say based upon the text because they describe these gateways in numerous texts. The problem is it just doesn't really seem to describe how they functioned. It just tells you what they did. And so I did offer in the book, one of the appendices suggests just a speculation as to how the devices might have worked. And I sort of went, since my background is in technology and science, I sort of went that route. But there are other possibilities that are available. But essentially what I suggest is that if they are this advanced species that it might be superior intelligence to our own, that maybe they've developed something in their realm similar to nanotechnology. And even physicists such as Dr. Michio Kaku has suggested that another dimensional race could essentially open up a very tiny wormhole and then transport information through that because it would require too much power to open up a large, stable mouth for some sort of gateway. But what they could do is open up a very small one and then send information through. And I suggest that maybe they could send information through or tiny little nanorobots, which would then come over to our side, and then they could pick up other materials like raw materials and start constructing the official gateway device, you know, on our end so that it could form a stable wormhole to then translate the beings from their dimension to our own.
On a regular mass basis, I guess. Where do you believe the device might have been made? One or two? How many? And then where was it?
It's hard to say, but essentially they're described all over the world. And usually they were housed in the pyramids, whether it's the step pyramids or the pyramids of Egypt, not every pyramid, but many of them. For instance, like the Great Pyramid of Giza. You hear archaeologists, they refer to it as the resurrection machine of the pharaoh, but most of them don't actually believe that anything happened. They just say the reason why there isn't a body there is because of grave robbers and things like that. That could be, or maybe the building actually functioned the way that it said and that it really did resurrect the pharaoh, but into another dimension.
So you think it's possible that the pyramids might be these receptors for these dimensional beings?
Yes. Essentially, it's not the pyramids themselves. I think that the shape of the pyramid or just the general structure was meant to convey other symbolic information.
Did the pyramids house the device?
Yeah. Generally, it was located at the top. For instance, the Mesopotamian ziggurats. They had several different tiers, and at the top, they always referred to it as the abode of the gods, where the gods would appear. And there were a lot of times where I think, according to Herodotus, he would say that they would have like high priestesses that would go up there and wait for the gods to appear, and then they would offer themselves to the gods.
Can you imagine what it was like during those times, Craig?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, but I really don't know if I'd want to live then or not.
I mean, as a reporter, wouldn't you love to just be able to look at that stuff?
Oh, definitely. Definitely in that context. Yeah, so it's one of those things where I really wish that we could have some sort of way of looking back into the past like that. Unfortunately, I haven't found a way to do that other than just through a study of language.
Okay, why have you ruled out, though, that these creatures could be planetary? Maybe even they came here through portals. Maybe they've learned that form of travel and technology. Why couldn't they come from some other star system?
I haven't completely ruled that out, but essentially, it just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Whenever you think about how far they'd need to travel and all the logistics of it, now perhaps we're just not thinking about it in terms that this advanced race would, and so we're limited in our understanding. But it just makes so much more sense with the gateway hypothesis, especially considering that that's what the text seemed to describe over and over and over again. For instance, a lot of people are familiar with the story of Nebuchadnezzar and the fiery furnace, with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the high priest, who are thrown into Nebuchadnezzar's furnace, and they don't get burned up like the other people, but then whenever Nebuchadnezzar looks inside, he sees a fourth being that's described as a son of the gods. So three go in, but four come out. So that right there, to me, is a definite take on a gateway technology.
And where did it go? Did they pick it up and take it with them? What happened to them?
I'm really not sure. A lot of them, it seems to be that they were deactivated or destroyed somehow. And I actually think that was part of the problem that it was sort of describing in the Nebuchadnezzar story, was that he didn't know how to operate that thing. By the time that he got a hold of one, he just didn't know what to do with it. And so that's why it described how some of the other people were killed operating the device, but yet the high priests were saved. And I think it's because they might have actually known about these gateways and maybe how to operate them. And so they were prepared before they walked into it, so that they wouldn't get destroyed.
Do you think the Ark of the Covenant might have been something like this?
It could have been. It's really hard to say. I've always been interested in the Ark of the Covenant, but it really didn't figure too much into my research.
People died when they touched the Ark.
Yeah, well,
remember when they opened it up or something?
Yeah, there's definitely a technological aspect to it. It's hard to say, but the descriptions just certainly indicate that there was some sort of power to it.
Well, there's no question that something dramatic happened on this planet thousands of years ago, whether it was an ET visitation, a dimensional visitation, the true, you know, a fallen angels story that you see in Genesis and read in Genesis. Something happened on this planet. And is it not true that most cultures all lead in that kind of direction, that something did happen?
Oh, definitely. That's what I found just so intriguing, was that you can look at just about every culture on the planet, and every one of them has some sort of story about this contact experience, whether you're looking at the Native Americans, and they refer to the Kachina spirits, which were, again, described with white skin and white hair. You move down to South America, and they refer to Quetzalcoatl, and again, described with white skin and white hair. You move over to the Middle of the East, and they have these same beings, the Shining Ones, white skin, white hair. You move to Europe, and you have elves, again, described with the same physical features. You even go over to China, and they refer to the Dragon Kings, or the Sons of Heaven. So throughout the entire world, you get these same references to the Sons of God, the Sons of Heaven, the Shining Ones, but the language has changed over time. And I think that that's part of the reason why so many people haven't quite picked up on it, because they just were looking at, like, just looking at Chinese mythology and then just looking at European mythology and not finding necessarily the connections in the original languages.
The stories in these various cultures that all seem to match up, somewhat in different ways, but they do match up when it comes to the end. How do you think these stories were passed down? How do you think they were remembered?
A lot of it was by word and storytelling, but another thing that we have to remember is, because a lot of times we like to play the telephone game and see how the story gets distorted for us.
Yeah, I remember that in high school. We'd line up 30 kids, and it got totally changed by the time it got to the last person.
Yeah, but now in the ancient world, they were much better at that, because that was their form of communication.
Yeah.
So they found ways of memorizing things. Oftentimes, it was through repetition. And so whenever you're reading a lot of the biblical text or just other texts from other cultures, many times you see the same words and phrases repeated over and over again. Now, whether that was to help them memorize it whenever they spoke it or also whenever they wrote it down, because it's aided tremendously whenever they've been ciphering tablets, because they might see the same phrase, but say part of that tablet's broken off. But yet, whenever they find another tablet describing similar material, they might find the rest of that phrase. And so then they know that they can go back to that other tablet and with considerable confidence put the text back in. And so then through that repetition, it actually helps them to decipher these languages now. And I just wonder if that was sort of a safety measure that they took in the ancient world, because they hoped that maybe we would be able to understand this message in the future, even if the tablets were destroyed.
Two longtime researchers, Zachariah Sitchin, Eric von Daniken, they have their own specific theories. How do you think they match up with some of the things you think you know?
Well, I think that they've offered a lot, and they've definitely gotten a lot of people interested in these topics. But I have a lot of problems with their material. I started out as a fan of both of those people. But over time, as I started researching them, I found more and more evidence that maybe I shouldn't be trusting their every word or just their research, because some of it seemed very skewed. Or I remember reading something about Eric von Daniken where he was caught by, I think, the Nova television program, where he had forged some pottery or something like that, and they caught him on it. And he said, well, yeah, I made it up, but it was so that everyone would believe me. And so I can sympathize where he's coming from, but I really don't think that's the way to get people to, you know, be won over to your side. And it had the opposite effect than what he wanted with me, because that was something that stuck with me. And I'm like, well, if you're going to make that up, then I don't really think I should be listening to you.
What do you use, Craig, as your evidence to back up your claims?
Well, basically, I've relied upon traditional academic scholars. Michael Heiser has been very influential in my material. Now, I might not always agree with everything that Michael writes, but I have a deep respect for what he does. And so, you know, it's basically whenever I want to check up on something, I might either email Michael or I might read through some of his papers, or I've purchased Akkadian dictionaries and other lexicons and things like that. And so whenever I was able, I would actually look up the words and terms for myself.
Okay, but we still don't really have, in really any of this, hard data, hard evidence, do we?
No, it really depends, and that's part of the problem that I bring up right at the beginning of the book, is saying, I really think there's something here that needs further examination, but I really hope that people will take it seriously enough that we can start looking for further evidence or develop methods of testing this material so that maybe scientists will take it seriously and we can start looking into the possibilities of these other dimensions that might coexist with our own, where these other beings exist, and that we can contact these other realms.
Could they have been other universes as well, where they came from?
It could be. It's really too hard to tell, but based upon some of the other things, like, for instance, I know we can get into EVP, that would indicate to me that these dimensions are much closer than some other universe, so to speak, and that it's dimensions that are right around us that we just don't see.
These angels that came from this other dimension, the dimension you claim, and they may have gone back. So are they there now in existence, parallel to us?
I would have to say so, yes. Essentially, it says that a majority of the fallen angels were imprisoned in what was known as Tartarus, or Sheol, which was essentially like the underworld.
That's hell, basically, right?
Yeah. But again, interesting thing in the text is that according to the text, it says that hell does not yet exist. So it says that essentially these angels were imprisoned, but they're waiting for the day of judgment, whenever then they'll be judged based on what they did. But until then, they're just imprisoned in these other realms, whereas some of the other angels that were maybe forgiven, they, like, for instance, Shemyaza, according to some of the legends, it says that he wasn't allowed back to heaven, but he wasn't found guilty enough to be imprisoned. So it's possible. I mean, it certainly makes for a nice sort of romanticized story about maybe the angel Shemyaza is still roaming the planet Earth.
Don't they die?
Well, it's hard to tell. A lot of times they're referred to as being immortal beings. Now, whether or not, it says that they could be killed, but generally it did not describe them as dying a natural death.
Because, I mean, they were obviously concerned about sunlight, right?
Yeah, I would say, but again, with the gateway technology, it's possible that maybe they could have a new body built for them whenever they got back to the gateway or something like that. So it's really tough to say. But based upon the readings, most times they're described as being immortal or at least having very long lifespans.
Okay. And all right, well, hold that thought, Craig. We're going to come right back with you. We're going to talk about some of these EVPs and also the afterlife on Coast to Coast AM.